This is the new Mos Def. Did you hear the new Mos Def?
I haven't. Dude, I hear it's awesome.
I'll bring you that CD. Yeah.
Killer.
You got,
yeah.
You guys
I heard the new Q-Tip's really good too.
Yeah, that one's all right. I don't know. I just don't really. I kind of ignore all the stuff that's been coming out with Tribe.
Yeah.
Related stuff, except for the Dilla stuff. I guess not really in Tribe, but.
No, I hear you. They had some cheesy follow-up albums. It's funny, they didn't really quite branch out on their own very well.
Yeah. But this Mos Def is phenomenal. Especially, I guess, considering that people were kind of expecting him to release, whatever album. You know.
I guess it's kind of whatever we thought of the last one. Is that it wasn't that it was bad, it was just that it wasn't as good as the Black on Both Sides.
Yeah,
and so that's tough to follow up an album that everybody... The Black Star album was... kind of like their, you know, their great coup de grace album together, and then his solo album was a good follow-up, and then it was kind of like this window of like, where'd you go? You turned into a movie star and kind of forgot about making albums or whatever.
Yeah. And you know, we could go into a question off this Mos album. Like, I think what makes this album, Ecstatic, really special is that a guy of Mos Def's social stature is putting pretty much himself into this album. He sounds like he loves what he's doing still. He's working really hard at you know, trying to do justice to the work he's doing. And I kind of see that a lot on Frozen Food Section's albums, because I know when you guys, I mean, John, I'm talking to John and, you know, a little bit to you earlier on and when I met you, you guys know that it's hard to get paid and at this, and I was wondering what keeps the passion alive for you with music and hip-hop?
That's a good question. I think it's kind of like, because I grew up doing a lot of acting and telling jokes, which was my original dream. I don't know if I ever told you that, but long before I ever wanted to be a singer or a rapper or anything, I wanted to be a comedian. Because I loved all the early 80s comics like Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor and George Carlin and that whole kind of wave, you know, Sam Kinison and all that kind of stuff. And like I was lucky enough to have parents that encouraged me to listen to a lot of stuff, even if it was too racy for most kids. Because they understood that I kind of had the intellect to differentiate between, you can't talk like this in the world necessarily, but comedians are allowed to say critically incorrect things that are hot button things to say. But I think for me it was always that these guys made it so clear, even in their act, like in their jokes, that, you know, this isn't an easy thing to do. People hate you for doing this. And that the more you stand out, the more that those kind of people seem to come out of the woodwork to try and keep you from either succeeding or from getting paid, or from trying to alienate and polarize your fan base. So I guess I kind of came in with this whole thing of, this is going to be tough. I never thought it would be real easy. So obviously making a leap into being a white rapper from the burbs of Elsa, you know, I didn't expect anyone to want to pay me for that, you know. So I guess the real thing that became the passion about it was that this was our soul's desire to do this. This had nothing to do with, let's do this to get chicks. It had nothing to do with, let's do this so black dudes will think we're down or whatever, or, you know, to build our street cred or whatever. It was truly because we were already writing music. I was already writing on the guitar. I already was writing music with bands. But what I didn't like about that was that you always had to run everything by 2, 3, 4 other guys that had an equal input and that almost inevitably had their own narcissism that they were dealing with, which meant they wanted to be the in control, they wanted to be the star, they wanted to have the final say on things. Whereas rap is like modern day rebel music, dude. I mean, it's individualistic. A lot of it is unapologetically so, where they say, you know, F you if you don't like it kind of thing. But for us, it wasn't even like F you if you don't like it. It was like, let's make the alternative to this like angry black materialistic music that everyone was so down on at that time, but give it our own fresh spin.
Yeah.
So I guess that was it, was that fresh spin kept us going, Kenji. It was that idea of, it's probably going to take 10 years. And we said that up front in 99 or 2000. It'll probably be till 2010 before we even really become become good at doing this, because it's going to take that long to learn how to write well, record well, mix and master well, promote well, you know, and then get paid well to do it. And you know, if you look at archetypes like Rhymesayers and all that, it took them 10 years. Now they're making money. Now they're, you know, playing Coachella main stage. Now they're, you know, putting out Felt 3, but they weren't doing that 10 years ago. 10 years ago, they could barely get their, you know, album out on a low-level, obscure label, you know?
Yeah.
So I guess that's the long way of answering it, but like what really kept us going, I think, was having a best friend that was equally invested in it. I think if it had just been me with no one else, like the Eminem, you know, Rabbit Against the World routine, I don't know if I would have stuck with it, because St. Louis especially was so aggressively against what we were doing for so long that I think I needed John's voice of encouragement to keep going. John saying, no, what we're doing is perfect. They just don't understand it. And that's takes a crazy kind of genius to say that, to say this is perfect when other people are listening to it and going, this is crap. Yeah. Or this isn't rap. That was another big one we got a lot. This isn't rap. This isn't hip hop. Or you're culture vultures. You're stealing from our culture. You know, we heard all those things. And then, of course, the other side is, you know, the racists who say we're white and eggs or whatever. You know, I mean, we got all that too, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, Prynne, coming home to Prynne, and God, it was like we were like Osama bin Laden around here.
I mean,
it was
even
scarier to them, you know.
Yeah.
But all those things together, I guess, didn't add up to the pleasure we got out of having breakthroughs with it. And I think originally it was freestyling. It was the fact that he and I could read each other's minds. And I'd never understood that before, about actually knowing what they're going to say before they say it.
Yeah.
And knowing where they're going before they get there. Mm-hmm. And being able to actually get a raised level of conscientious thought where, you know, that one mind kind of metaphor was in effect, because it really wasn't me or him thinking half the time. Half the time we're, you know, blown out of our gourds anyway. So, I mean, it wasn't like we were really doing a lot of thinking. But yet we still could go for hours and do that and say things we never conceived of saying. Mm-hmm. And the other person knew where we were going to say it, you know, and we're like, well, how does that work? Yeah. But I guess we figured if we keep at it like that, that over time it could turn into this or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite John tracks, too.
Yeah, I think this is Jay Top at his finest in rhymes.
Lyrically, yeah, he's on point with all the punches.
Yeah.
Two parts pay him, and one part Dave Lynch. Yep, no, that's a good song, man.
Just aside, I went back to California and met some DJs, and they played some shows that I went to. And every show, I brought 20 CDRs of just frozen food shit. And
right on, man.
Just passed them out. You know, people don't buy your music until they know who you are.
And DJs will spin it for them if they like it.
And you know, these DJs and performers that I met, they're the same. You know, the same as you guys. They love what they're doing, and they're white.
Right.
Some are black, but some are white too. And you know, I think once people get to that realization that, you know, these people performing, they're doing it because they love it, and they're doing it, and there's a connection there. You know,
right.
It doesn't have to be so like, you're doing this and I'm doing this thing over here that I call it this, you know. There's a unity, and I guess I was wondering, does it always take 10 years to establish yourself when you're, you know, subverting the ego and in hip hop and doing something outlandish? I mean,
I guess if you're not like a teenager and writing Soulja Boy Tell 'em raps, you know, that's the thing.
What's up? How's it going? Oh, just watching it?
Yeah, drop that off.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah. Not a lot, man. This is Tucker Booth.
Absolutely, Tucker.
Yeah. Good to see you.
Nice to see you, absolutely. Yeah. How did your gig go?
At Blueberry?
Yeah.
It went great. Yeah, it went really well. I was going to tell him about that anyway.
Yeah, we're doing an interview right now.
We were talking about doing stuff for the love and kind of doing it undeterred by whether you get paid or not, or whether you get validation or not, or pats on the back or not.
Nice.
And that show at Blueberry is a case in point, because I promoted shows in St. Louis for 7 years, got paid by these same people that I went, you know, and was doing the show for at Blueberry. I did this show for free, didn't make a dime. I actually was a paying customer all night. I bought things for myself and for all my friends. So, I mean, I was a customer of the establishment, and I did that wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
And I didn't make really any money, but the opportunity was such a great opportunity that meant more to me than the money. It truly did. Because I didn't need the money. I didn't need it. It'd be nice, but I didn't need it. And I guess I thought, you know, anyone that isn't humble enough to think that they don't still need to pay their dues, no matter how much success they've had in the past, hasn't really mastered the secret yet. Because the secret is, it's not really about doing stuff to get paid or to be famous. It's not. And those that spend all their time focused on that burn out faster than the others. Because whenever that grace period ends for them or that heyday ends for them, then they feel incompetent because they don't have that.
And you can see that with a lot of the mainstream rappers, the rappers who come out, like, and their main gig is like, I sell drugs, yo, come to me for this, you know?
Right.
And those rappers are maybe cool for like a second on the radio. I mean, the radio, I'm thinking about Gucci Mane right now.
Sure, yeah, he's real popular at the moment.
Yeah, and, you know, I guess the Southern rap is in right now, but a lot of that shtick of, you know, I'm making crack and I'm selling it, or like, you know, I'm a businessman and like, you can come to me for music and you can come to me for drugs or something like that.
Or even just style over substance debate, you know what
exactly,
I mean? Like
yeah.
Style meaning just you gotta do it like everybody else does it and make the same record because that's what you think will sell instead of writing something substantial that's really from your heart, you know?
Uh-huh.
I have a lot of friends that use that excuse and cop out. They would say, dude, I really want to write about God, but I feel like I have to write about gangster stuff because that's all that anyone in hip hop wants to hear is gangster music. And it's like, well, dude, why don't you just write about God because that's what's in your heart and change the game, or not, but do it anyway and be brave and be willing to be a sacrificial lamb even if you become one, because you know what, wouldn't you rather be that than just be a sheep?
You know,
be a follower?
I don't listen to rap a whole lot, but I remember Eminem was so big when he could complain.
Right.
But once he made it big, he had nothing else to say, you know?
And he disappeared for a while, and he's a good example of a guy who took a 3-year hiatus that wasn't necessarily by choice.
Oh,
you know what I mean? He didn't make that by choice. That was because he felt out of sorts. Like, what do I do now that everybody likes me? What do I do now? But you know what ended up happening to him? Was he tried to tear himself down just to get some material.
Really?
Where he spent 3 years self-destructing in the middle of supposedly his success, you know? And you think, gosh, that sounds hellish. That you're rich and famous and you finally made it by anybody's standards of what made it means, you know, where you're a household name, and yet now instead of trying to use that to promote something new or better, or, you know, look at what I've learned over a life of taking some hard knocks kind of thing, he just wanted to keep giving himself hard knocks to have something to write about, you know?
It's amazing.
It's kind of abusive. Anyway,
see you guys. I was thinking, what if been can you think of some moments when you've been making a track or performing where you just felt like I'm being really honest right now, and this track really, or this what I'm doing right now just is me and I feel satisfied with this work? Can you?
Yeah, I mean, I recently we did a track that was for this ex-boyfriend thing with one of the Helias beats that we got back. And I had written it all in LA during the midst of my wife's pregnancy, which, just as a side note, was probably about 8 or 9 months of me really looking myself in the mirror every day and thinking, are you just deluding yourself? Should you just give up the pipe dream and get a job and, you know, the whole nine, the thing every artist has to face at some point, because I felt like somehow the implication was because you're going to be a dad and because you're married now and all this, that you're no longer cool, which makes you no longer relevant to younger people. And, you know, American Idol cutoff age is 28 and you're 30 and yada, 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 down the list it went about why I couldn't still dream of being a pop star with any of this. So once again, am I doing this to be popular or am I doing this because I really care? And I thought, well, you know what? Quit writing pop songs then. Quit writing stupid hooks and start writing some real content. And I made a pact. I mean, it's been a tough pact because I am a hook man more than almost a verse writer by nature. But I said, I'm going to write a song that's nothing but verse. No hook, no break, just straight, for 3.5 minutes, I'm going to write raps. And it took me like 2 months to write one song, dude, which usually I can bang one out in an afternoon if I'm really in the zone. But yeah, I felt that feeling that you're talking about this is really me. This may not be me as in this is my life today, but these are my feelings, this is my soul, this is my passion, these are my reflections on the subject of breakups. That there was a lot of my past in this song. And that beyond that, I still knew that people would misinterpret it. Because that's, you know, if you're a painter, man, you go through this more than anybody does. You make a painting and you think it's, you know, about domestic violence, and someone else thinks it's like, you know, about world peace or something. I mean, it's like, you cannot control what people think of your stuff, but you can control what you feel you're putting into it. Yeah. So yeah, I feel that.
Yeah. And you know, I really find it ironic. I like the frozen food section does, because you guys aren't trying to perpetuate the similar notions that hip hop has to be about egotistical, stereotypical rap things that, you know, I'm saying rap things because we're just exposed to this rap that, you know, it's fun, but it's just play, you know.
It gets played out too fast.
Thinking about how I can say I'm dope in a million different ways. And that's, you know, some people get really creative, like I think Lil Wayne sometimes is pretty crazy with that.
But you know, it's funny, Carter 3 or Blueprint 3 being recent examples of really hot albums that did well. I think both those albums are brilliant, but I can't listen to them very often.
Yeah.
I mean, I can only take it in small doses because it's still just the same old materialistic lingo. There isn't any deeper content than that. They've decided that this is the platform and the kind of the status quo that they're going to take, and they're the best at it. I mean, Wayne's the best freestyler at it, and Jay's the best writer at it, you know, obviously, but they're still just writing drug dealer lyrics to me, dude. I mean, really, at the end of the day, that's what they're writing.
Yeah.
You know, they're just the most swaggy drug dealers of all the rappers, you know?
Yeah. But I find it ironic that I feel like I see you guys in the music when you guys aren't talking about yourself, and also you as an artist feel yourself in the music when you're not trying to be really egotistical and just, you know, I guess just really doing the goofy things that I guess characterize you, but don't necessarily like explicitly state, you know, like, it's all me, baby, you know? Like,
that's an interesting thing to say, because, you know, what's funny is that, you know, as you're saying, I'm going, wow, and we've struggled with so much ego and all that, you know, like our own in the process. But that it's translated to that makes me happy that you hear that in there, because we did have that as an ideal. That ideally we wanted people to understand that this was our best reflection of what we felt God was to us, of what Christian Science was to us, all those things. And that, yeah, we still talk about things that like Christian Scientists bristle at, because that was our life and our life is ours. But yeah, we were raised in Christian Science, which was our life, and that was our life too. So we couldn't just separate the two and act like, oh, we're just gonna do Mary Baker Eddy arrangements on an album for the rest of our life. We couldn't do that.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't us. Although that being said, I'm working on one right now with a friend who is writing a children's book about the hymns, the 7 hymns she wrote, and I'm gonna be doing arrangements of some of her hymns. So, you know, and the thing is, you can put your heart into that too. That you can find some of me in those songs, because those are our songs. Those are like folk songs for Christian Scientists, you know, I mean, they really are.
Yeah.
But almost back to your point though about ego and rap and, you know, I'm the man and all these different ways of saying it. John started out that way. He was so condescending and narcissistic about anything rap related. Like, he was the authority back in that time. It was so funny. Like, he'd hear a new act and in 5 seconds he'd be like, that's trash. And I'd look at him, I go, you don't even know their catalog. How can you call it trash? He goes, trash. And I was always the guy that was trying to find the good and stuff on the front end. And it's funny, over time, I almost felt like we switched places, where I got jaded by hearing all the junk. And also from these people that had no business being rappers, as far as I was concerned, dominating the clubs I was trying to book, stealing my time on stage, cutting me off in freestyle sessions when everybody wanted to hear me and nobody wanted to hear them. And you know, it became this kind of this jaded feeling of, why do I have to keep fighting to prove myself when I'm so obviously better than these folks, kind of attitude. And yeah, the problem is, because there are folks that are above you that are way better than you. And yes, you're dealing with the dregs, but you know, the bottom line is there's people way better than you. And that's why you have to keep fighting to carve out your niche.
Yeah.
It's because you can't ever rest. You know, if you really want to do rap, you can't ever rest on what you've already done.
Yeah.
You know, it is a what have you done for me lately medium more than just about any.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
And I often, did you just mention Drake or?
I didn't. But,
oh, okay. I thought I said, I heard you said you got to deal with the Drakes.
Oh, the Drakes. But, yeah, the Drakes, like the lowly ones.
Okay.
But
yeah,
or the Drakes.
But
that's
I'm
funny.
I'm thinking of Drake because you're familiar with,
sure,
Drake and the Young Money group.
Yeah.
Like that, he's I don't know. There's a sense to me that he kind of moved up more because he plays to a lot of what people expect hip hop to be these days. And I guess as an artist who's trying, you and John are in the frozen food section, are really trying to carve out your own niche and go a different direction. Do you feel like there's still any expectations placed on you that you tend to actually roll with instead of resist?
Yeah, and sadly it's what our wheelhouse crowd wants to hear. You know, our wheelhouse crowd wants to hear goofball monkey stuff. They want to hear a lot of tongue-in-cheek and satirical takes on things. You know, we do it earnestly, but we're obviously kind of, you know, mocking the subject or, so, you know, kind of feeling like it's hard to really write something that's emotional and serious when you know your crowd wants you to be cracking punchlines and wisecracking on everything.
Yeah.
I also think the other thing is that a lot of them are like into this whole kind of like, you know, pothead rap mode where they want to hear pothead rap for potheads written by potheads about smoking pot and all this, and feeling like we have walked that dangerous line with President of being known solely for the fact that we wrote a song called Born High that kind of became like the theme song to the record, and we didn't mean for it to. We did not really mean for it to. Hi.
Hi.
Hey, Joy, how are you doing?
Good. I just had an idea. I saw the car here, so I thought you were still there. You know, maybe his article. Are you writing an article?
It's probably going to be in the spring. Okay. Not really, yeah.
Okay, but I was thinking, you know, maybe that's a good place, Tucker, for you to say, I'd really like to come back and play at Principia to sort of, you know,
back or
redeem myself or whatever, you know. Maybe that's the place to say it. I think that'd be a cool.
Right, that's good. Okay.
Cool message.
That's
good. Know?
That's a good idea.
I just was walking.
That's
back
a good idea.
To my
She's down in the living room.
Okay.
With Max.
I was walking back and I saw your car. So
maybe you can go down and say hi to them.
Okay.
Tell her it's probably still gonna be a little bit.
Okay.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
All right. Bye.
Yeah. Let's see. You're talking about.
Oh, well, you know, and the fact was we loved that song because for us, all that was for us was a way to kind of exercise the demons of feeling like Principia had turned us into these kind of like anti-heroes where like the kids thought we were awesome and the administration thought we were subversives and trying to tear down at the, you know, the moral fabric of the school. And, you know, the question, why wasn't I born high, ? Was for them, not for the kids. It wasn't saying, hey guys, let's all get high. You know, it was saying, why wasn't I born high? Because if I was, then I wouldn't be trying to chase these dragons down, you know, rabbit holes that don't lead you there, you know?
Yep.
Hi.
Hi.
Molly.
Oh, hey,
yo. Good.
Saying.
What's up?
Hey.
Are you saying hey?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Well,
hey.
Later.
So, I don't know. I mean, you know, not to beat the point to death, but I had a lot of people come up at shows during those couple years right after that album got popular that would say things like, dude, you know, I'd smoke a big one every night to that song, and oh my gosh, and like, you know, it's like the greatest drug song of all time and all this, and like,
yeah, yeah. And that was my initial reaction to that album when I first heard it. When you gave it to me freshman year, I listened to it a couple times and was like, yeah, this is stoner music right now.
Because we were getting stoned and making music, and that was obvious.
And I kind of was like, this is cool. But then, you know, I met John, like a year later, and you know, he kind of, I think I had briefly talked to you about music, and I didn't really, you know, get a good perspective of what you guys were trying to do. And John basically said, you know, like, all this stuff people have really misunderstood and aren't really seeing that, you know, he played that White Boy song for me.
Yeah,
it's
that's a tough one for people to understand.
It's like people, you know, we're hesitant to put this out on something because it's just like people will think we're racist, but we're pulling the Sarah Silverman card, I guess, is what he was saying. But how much do you think of your work has been, do you feel like as an artist you've been more understood than misunderstood?
I think I have. You know, I'm lucky that way, maybe even more so than John, because the critical analysis from the Peanut Gallery when people are talking about me versus John in their eyes is always that because John's delivery is so nasal and kind of scratchy and grating on the ears, that you have to really be someone who can dial in the lyrics and message to be able to appreciate it fully. Because you can't judge it from a technical standpoint of, you know, it being on key or it being, you know, harmonious to the ear. You know, kind of almost like Dylan, you know, it's like the debate is Dylan or Springsteen. You know, it's like Springsteen hits all his notes clean and puts on a super duper rock and roll show, but a lot of his lyrics seem kind of watered down and for the blue collar masses instead of for the intellectuals. Dylan writes songs that are for every level of human life, from geniuses all the way down to the simplistic, but his voice is so hard for most people to listen to that he gets reamed for that. If you're a hater of Dylan, you immediately go to his voice is nasally and whiny and off key. It's the first thing that they'll say. That's what I hear about John a lot. His voice is whiny and nasally, and you know, like, I can't stand to listen to it. I've heard a lot of people say that, especially grown-ups when they're talking about rap. They will go there. Whereas I think what they say about me is that you seem to have more of the classically trained voice, even if you are kind of ragged with it. You know, that I did take voice lessons when I was a kid. I did, you know, sing in show choir and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I had that experience. So there is this part of me that wants that harmoniousness to come through on the song, even if it is a wild indie rap song, you know. And also they say that you write lyrics that aren't quite over people's heads, that even if you're writing with big words, that you choose words that we can understand, whereas John oftentimes will use his intellect to flex big time, and you can perceive it any way you want, but of course then it will be misperceived because he's writing it in really cryptic ways. He's not writing it for everyone.
It's polarizing, definitely, yeah.
Right, a lot of people say it sounds like he's a know-it-all and it makes them feel dumb. Yeah. I've heard people say that.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not bashing any music at all that the top makes, but there's certain times I think where, like the Babe persona, that one I think is really, you're either gonna get that or you're not gonna get it.
Or you're really not gonna like it, yeah.
And there are times I think when that happens, and I don't think he really understands that people, I mean, but I think that's cool that he's making it, but at the same time, I don't think that if you're gonna make something specifically because you like it, you know,
can't expect everyone to like it then.
Yeah, you know. But you know, I think if you, well, we're studying this whole, I'm in a practical criticism class for English, and we're studying artist's intent and how the artistic process and whether or not, how a work becomes genuine in the eyes of people and authentic. And are there pieces that you've written that you feel maybe, not that you weren't authentic in making it, but that you think people just don't see Tucker Booth in, or...
Sure. You know, and sadly, you know, it seems like those songs aren't even always the rap songs, because, you know, as you know, I write a lot of acoustic music too, and piano ballads and blah, 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 that are just straight up singing, where I keep thinking this is my... they can't miss it kind of song, you know, where like it's so obvious and it's done in a way that no one can be put off by it, because there's no rap here, it's just straight singing, and I'm singing it pretty and I'm trying to make it sound good, and yet they still miss the boat by a mile, you know. And I go, wow, you know, even when you bring it in the form that they understand, they don't always get it, you know. And when you talk about artistic intent, I think an artist that is good to themselves just accepts the fact that people aren't going to get it, not because they have to hate people for that, but just because people don't know them, and unless they get to know them well or were a part of the experience, they won't understand everything that you were going through at the time, unless you're just a master of like reflecting what you're going through at the time in your piece, you know. And some people really are good at that, you know, that can really write about, I don't know, like Kanye Through the Wire or something, where he's writing about his car wreck and he's still got his jaw wired shut, and you can hear that, you know, in his voice. You can hear that he's slurring his words because he's got a wire in his jaw and all that. And, you know, that's a moment where you really feel his pain. Mm-hmm. It's hard to even listen to that song because you go, man, why don't you just rest that yeah. mouth, you know?
Yeah.
But that was a moment where I think most people understood that, yeah, because they'd just seen the news. They knew he'd gotten in a car wreck. They knew he'd almost died. Now he's back writing a song about it, you know? That's one of those precious moments where you can pull it off. But, you know, even that, I could play that song for like a lot of people and they wouldn't get it. They'd go, what the hell is this about? Chaka yeah. Khan sample? Yeah. What are you doing, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, I guess that's it. It's like, no matter what you're writing, you know, I guess the anecdote is always, I play these shows, you know, these cover shows for people at clubs and bars around Hermosa, where I'm playing a lot of sing-along songs and then trying to interject a few of my own. And I'll have that new song I'm like really, really hyped on that I just wrote, and I can't even play it enough. I like it so much. And I play it out for the first time and I tell them it's the new song, and everyone's already been riding with me to all the covers. And then I get to that, and right after, you got that like frat boy with the white baseball cap coming up like, dude. I mean that song is great and all. I mean it's great and all. But you know, I really need to hear some Jack Johnson, man. I hear some Jack Johnson banana pancakes, man. You know any Dave Matthews, man? You know any Dave Matthews and Tim Reynolds? Any Dave and Tim?
Bro, play some Dispatch.
Yeah, seriously. I wish it was even that cool. It's always like, dude, you know what would be great right now? Oasis Champagne Supernova. Yeah. I mean, it's like, oh,
blast
geez, man.
Off, man.
I want to hear some Green Day. I want to hear some Green Day Time of Your Life, you know? And it's like, dude, why don't you give me a new Green Day if we're going to do this? You know, I'd rather hear a new one than an old one, you know?
Yeah.
But you know what I'm saying? It's like people misinterpret because they're used to what they're used to. And that's pop music, dude. That's why when somebody new and groundbreaking comes out, they get hated on for 2-3 years.
Yeah.
No matter who they are. Because everyone goes, they're not like the other guy that I'm jocking right now. There's some other stuff. And they don't understand what the other stuff means.
Yeah.
Because they haven't taken the time to consider it. You know?
Yeah. That's a good question, too, right there. What do you think about the internet and the role of experiencing music? I know that John, I've just seen him. You know, he hustles with his Twitter, his blog, his MySpace, MySpaces,
right.
His Facebook, his website. I was just wondering, with that promotional model paired with the fact that almost every artist right now has the same model, and the listener has the ability to consume a music kind of as a, in a sense, quantity over quality. Do you have any thoughts on the internet and the role of your music?
I think it became the great equalizer, because suddenly all this "we got to get a label deal" rhetoric disappeared, and it became "we got to get a MySpace page and a Twitter." You know, I mean, that's what it became, and you need it. It's important, and it can launch a lot of people, as we've seen. Things go viral all the time, and nobody's become celebrities overnight now, truly. Instead of it just being a fantasy, there really are overnight sensations that come out of YouTube and come out of all that, you know. But you're right, everybody's got it, so you can't just rest on, well, I got my website up now, I got my MySpace page, now everybody's gonna find me. You know, you can't do that. You know, you gotta pimp that and every other angle you can find to try and make it happen. I still am a big believer in word of mouth. And people can call me old-fashioned for saying that, but I think it's better advertising than even getting a billboard or putting yourself in the Yellow Pages or whatever.
Why do you think that?
Well, I think word of mouth works because not only do you create real fans that way, where, like the street act. I'd sit in the street in the freezing cold on Del Mar Boulevard with nobody around. Everyone walking by me going, you're crazy. What, aren't you freezing? You know, or worse, you know, you suck, you know. And then one person would stop, and I'd light them up like a Christmas tree. And next thing I know, these people have told 5, 10, 15 friends of theirs by phone or text message or whatever. Blam, now I got a crowd, and it's the middle of winter. And they all line up and buy a CD when it's over. And I sell, you know, $100 worth of CDs in 5 minutes to these people. I've had that happen many times. Enough times to know that it's not just some sort of, like, random happenstantial thing. You know, it's real. And that word of mouth, all those people go and tell their friends, oh my gosh, do you know what I just saw today? I just saw this white guy playing a classical guitar freestyling. And everyone goes, I'd love to see that. Well, come on down. He plays at the Ben and Jerry's every day. Now I've got a crew. I've got the whole neighborhood buzzing about it. And every year or two, it'd be a whole new crew buzzing around the neighborhood. So you'd see new crews that would start to get it. And then they'd meet other people that already knew me. That's where the word of mouth really starts to start multiplying exponentially, is that when people start finding each other and going, you know about Tucker Booth? Oh my gosh, you've got stuff of his I don't have and all this. And, you know, oh, you haven't heard the ballet or whatever. And then people are, it turns them into cultishly devoted fans. Now, that doesn't mean you're making money off these people, but it does mean you've created a lot of love and loyalty.
People know who you are. And
then the next step is also word of mouth works, because that's how I've met some of the most influential people that have ever been able to really help me. Now, I'm not talking about just people that are fans. I'm talking about people that got me in studios.
Yeah.
MTV scouts in L.A. that saw me freestyling 10 years ago in a Puma store that got me in their studios and hypercritically analyzed my whole look, act, flow, hooks, delivery, and broke it down so scientifically to me when it was done as a thank you, but we're going to pass. It was, you need to write more hooks.
Constructive criticism.
They said, write 2,000 hooks and get back to me. Uh-huh. I wrote 2,000 hooks and I never got back to them. But I decided I didn't really want to go that route. I didn't want to be a making the band kind of star. I wanted to be, you know, self-made kind of star. I didn't want to ride on somebody else's coattails like Idol or Puff Daddy or whoever that was. Blowing people up. I didn't need that, you know, because that wasn't substantial fame. You know, substantial fame means you made it yourself. Mm-hmm. So you can't, no one can take it away from you because it's yours.
Yeah.
You know?
You just dogs on a leash, like those, what is, I don't know, the groups, Danity Kane or.
Yeah, yeah.
Those girls just are.
Pussycat dolls or whatever, where they're just interchangeable. You can just plug in a new pussycat doll and roll out the tour again, you know?
Yep.
They don't really even write their music, so they don't have any stake in the integrity of it. They're just hot looking chicks that can dance, you know.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, and there, you know, and I'm not hating on that music either, because there's a place for it in the world. And you know, I think John Mayer is a really talented songwriter, and he doesn't write his own songs, you know. So I mean, or doesn't write many of them. So I mean, but I think he's talented, and I see why people like him, and
yeah.
All that, you know.
Is yeah. Now, can you talk a little bit about some of your influences musically and also outside of music, that maybe different art mediums or just people who have influenced you?
I think for John and I, you can hear in that Split Face track, but like David Lynch, before I was even old enough to understand what he was even talking about, artistically, visually, emotionally, and a little bit fantastically, was a huge influence, because alter egos run all throughout David Lynch's movies. You know, these people are four people at once kind of deal. And I felt like that a lot. I felt a little crazy in my own head, because I knew I had other people inside me that were, you know, shades of me, but weren't me, the relative human being that you see, you know. And so I'd say guys like that, you know, musically, there were so many when I was a kid. You know, I really loved, like, early love is like Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder and a lot of the, like, 60s and 70s Motown and soul music, you know, Sam Cooke and, you know, Smokey Robinson and Marvin Gaye and, you know, all that kind of music. I love that music because there's a lot of soul and passion in it. And then as I got older, after Michael Jackson kind of became uncool, you know, it was like Bob Dylan, because my dad had a lot of Bob Dylan records, and, you know, a voice like that, that was so his own. You could never mistake Dylan for anyone, you know, but that he also had lyrics that were so insightful and that were so cutting down to the core of what was really going on in the world in a poetic way, which is a tough thing to do, where you can pull it off as poetry, but also as, you know, social satire or social criticism. You know, other art, you know, the alternative rock movement of the 90s, you know, late 80s and 90s, you know, Jane's Addiction and Sonic Youth and Nirvana and Soundgarden and, you know, on and on through all those, Dinosaur Jr. and all those bands, you know, there was a place for that. Alice in Chains and all that, you know, I remember thinking all that music definitely did speak to the angst that I felt in those years. Because that angst was saying, we don't want to be sellouts. Mm-hmm. But we're kind of forced to if we even want this music to be heard by you. Yeah. We have to sell out.
Yeah.
And that's why Kurt Cobain shot himself, as far as I'm concerned, is because he realized, oh shit, we can't really do this and like not be whores. You know, like it's just the way it is.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a sad thing, just to kill yourself over that. But I think he killed himself more over that than over a drug habit. Because you see a lot of burnout, you know, Grateful Dead heads that can play till they're, you know, 65 on heroin or whatever. I mean, it's not impossible.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that killed him. It was either that or his wife.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know, all that music, you know, obviously the 90s rap movement, where it kind of branched out of the early kind of rappity rap kind of stuff and turned more into like the alternative movement and into gangster rap, because all that was really intriguing to me as well. I loved it. Early gangster rap is great. You know, the early Snoop, the early Dre, the early NWA stuff. You know, G-Funk, yeah. All this stuff is phenomenal. And especially how they liked the conscientious stuff too. So there wasn't this like marginal line about, oh, you know, the Tribe Called Quest, you're not cool. I mean, they could rock a show with NWA, you know, or, you know, there wasn't any of that, you're not down with our club kind of thing, you know. As I got older, like out of high school, and I got away a little bit from all that stuff, it really became like George Clinton, Parliament, Funkadelic, starting to see the roots of where a lot of that came from, where the samples came from, where the breaks came from, getting back into that kind of soulful stuff, you know, that late 60s, 70s kind of funk and soul.
That's kind of what I'm getting into.
Music. There's a ton of stuff in there too.
Rick James.
Love Rick James music, you know. Yeah, he's a lot like a George Clinton. It's just a composer who was way more brilliant than people even gave him credit for, because he acted so crazy, you know, just like George Clinton did. People only remember George Clinton for his crazy hair.
Yeah.
They don't know, understand that he produced so many classic albums, you know.
I had a philosophy too about his music, and it kind of speaks to how music is perceived really culturally, at least in the United States. I think I haven't been to Europe, but I went to Australia, and a lot of those people really, the image of music does not mesh with the sound or the content of music,
right?
And I think that's really cool.